Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 67. My name's Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview people from the worlds of TV, radio, writing, and today, all of those things. Armando Iannucci is a writer, TV director, radio producer, and satirist, although he kept saying during the show he doesn't consider himself a satirist, and we covered why he thinks that and why he knows people have that label for him but aren't quite sure why. It was really interesting to hear his take on that and his take on people's perception on him, which is a subject matter I love getting into with performers especially, but also the industry folk that I talk to. So industry folk, let's go with it. We covered loads of subjects from moving radio shows to TV, how you can move TV shows to films, how you write for both a US and a UK audience, how to get stuff on the telly, his views on the difference between radio and TV and why one is more fun in different ways than the other, how he picked who he's going to collaborate with, how he found the right management, and just everything. We covered loads in this interview. He's best known for his work with Chris Morris on The Day to Day and on The Hour, as well as Knowing Me and Knowing You and the Armando Iannucci Show. I think this podcast would be great for anyone who wants to know the history behind some of their favourite TV and radio shows, as well as how they were made, what production limitations they were, what artistic compromises had to be made due to budget restrictions or timing. Just anyone who wants to nerd out, but also any performers who really want to know the nitty-gritty of why something was made in a certain way, if it was an artistic choice or a budget constraint, and also the behind the scenes, just what goes on with someone who keeps changing it up and keeps adjusting all the different subjects that he's working on and all the different areas that he explores, and why he keeps changing it up and why he keeps trying to find new and exciting projects for himself, for his audience, for everyone. And I really enjoyed his take on the fact that he kind of has to be aware of the fact that every couple of years there's a new audience watching TV who have no idea who he is, so he has to really bring his A game, and it doesn't matter that he's famous to a certain number of people. I loved how grounded he was. It was amazing. There were a few points in this, as there are in any interview you have with any guest, where you might slip up and make a mistake, and he said, I've got to leave them in. That was the rule we had in the room, in his flat. So I left them in, but I also left in him telling me to leave them in, because he didn't say I had to take that out. As a result, you'll hear where I slipped up. It was only two or three times where I got some facts wrong, but to be honest with you, I'm fine with it. I'm cool with it. I've dealt with it. I'm still dealing with it, but that's not your issue. That's my cross to bear. As always, please do not forget to subscribe and join the Facebook group, which is called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. Now, without any more delays, this is Armando Iannucci.
I mean, I started in radio because I was a huge, huge fan of radio comedy. I mean, at school, this would be in the 70s. There was lots of Radio 4 comedy and Radio 2 comedy. Things like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and, you know, old regulars like News Quiz, quote-unquote panel shows, Weekending, which I always thought was the height of satirical sophistication at the time, Radioactive and that sort of thing. And I was just a huge fan. It was a show on called The Burkus Way, which was a hilariously sort of surreal, I mean, just very imaginative, lots of wordplay, written by Andrew Marshall and David Renwick, who went on to write lots of, you know, One Foot in the Grave and classic two Ronnie sketches like The Mastermind, answering one question behind all the time, a lot of verbal tricks like that. And it was just a joy. And I used to record it onto, you know, cassette tapes and play them back, and me and my brother were big Radio Comedy fans. I shared a room. I'm sorry, I haven't a clue all that stuff. So I just, you know, I loved Radio Comedy, and at school I would write comedy, but I always thought I want to make Radio Comedy. And I loved other comedy. I loved Monty Python and Woody Allen films, and you know, I watched TV stuff, but it was radio was the real thing I was absolutely obsessed with. And so when I was at university, I just made a tape of live stuff I did, and I sent it to Radio Scotland, who were looking for some new comic talent and also some new music presenting talent. And I got the job as a kind of music presenter. I was the world's uncoolest music presenter, but I was allowed to write my own funnies. And that was great, because Radio Scotland in Glasgow was like, it was a huge building, because it was like the national radio station. It was like a local, it was like a regional station, but on a national level. So it had endless studios. It had a sports department, a news department, a features department. So it met, and a gram library, a sound effects library, any music I could, you know, dig up from the library. So I was able to go and write sketches, but also get other people in to perform them, use the studios, use all the props, the sound effects, the music, work with editors who'd worked on sports shows. And that's where I picked up the sort of technique of mimicking other styles. Because, you know, if you wanted to do like a football commentary or a horse racing commentary, you could actually dig out the special mic that they use, the sort of close lip mic that they use that covers the, you know, so you could end up doing that, you know. And it was great. And that's when I learned an awful lot of the, just the techniques of directing actors and also producing, you know, cutting material, sitting there in those days with a razor blade and trying to graph and actually physically cutting the tape and splicing it together and stuff. And then I just applied. The job came up in BBC Radio Comedy in London, and I applied. And it was about the one very Machiavellian, very, very Machiavellian cynical thing I ever did was I said to Radio Scotland, I think I could be better for you if you paid for me to go down to London and shadow BBC Radio 4 comedy for a week. And they said, that sounds an excellent idea. Wow. Paid for me to go down and follow Radio 4 producers around for a week. And I then came back up, and then a job came up in Radio 4, and I applied for it. And because I kind of had come down and shadowed them, they kind of knew who I was, and I was able to also show them my pieces and stuff.
You don't ask, you don't get.
And, you know, that. So I basically siphoned off Scottish license fee payers money in order to, you know, better myself. I am basically a crook.
Well, it's like an Arts Council grant they didn't know they were giving you.
Well, yeah, except they knew because I asked for it. But I mean, that wasn't I didn't sit down in my bedroom and think, this is what I'll do. This is how I'll stiff them.
Yeah, you're not that methodical. No.
But fundamentally, that's what happened. And so I then start off in BBC Radio, Radio 4 and Radio 2, making the shows that I actually grew up liking, like the News Quiz and Weekending and quote unquote. And actually, it was quite bleak. It was bleak because then I realised that I wanted to do something different. I didn't want to do those shows. I wanted to do something new.
Didn't working on the shows that you loved as a kid make them different for you? Or, like, did it ever ruin the memory of it for you?
It kind of did. And, in fact, I remember being asked if I wanted to produce I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue. And I said no, because I love it so much. I really don't want to go anywhere near it. Do you know what I mean? I want to stay a listener to that show without any memory of how it's put together, the things that don't work and all that. But it was a great learning experience. I mean, to do something like the News Quiz, for you end up reading every newspaper every day and getting an overview of how news works and how the media works. And then, you know, we had just one writer of the script at the time, and he was always very late. So I'd end up writing the script until he came in. So that was good experience. And it was Barry Took who was the presenter at the time. And it was good, to mix with the likes of Ian Hislop and Peter Cook we had on. And that was all fun. It was a great experience. So don't get me wrong. But I sort of felt I don't want to go down in history as the 13th producer of the News Quiz and the 28th of Weekending. I kind of want to do something else.
No one wants to be the 20th president of the United States, you know. They want to be the first.
I wonder who that was. probably turned out to be someone like Abraham Lincoln or something.
What did he do?
But so it was great. But what was great about the radio comedy department was you were literally this corridor of just different producers of different rooms and lots of writers mixing around. And you get to know other writers. You can bring in writers that you know. It was the same time I knew Lee and Herring from university, and they were about 3 or 4 years younger than me. So they were just beginning to sort of emerge as writers. So when I did Weekending, I basically gave them 50% of the show to write, and it was really good fun. I mean, it wasn't in any way topical. I remember there was one week where the Birmingham Six? I can never remember.
That's the numbers.
miscarriages of justice. People were, I think it was the Birmingham Six. It was the week they were released.
Yeah.
So Lee and Herring came up with the All New Adventures of the Birmingham Six, which was just like a cartoon series with these six people in a van, kind of correcting justice. And it was really funny, but there were lots of letters afterwards saying, I don't really think you've homed in on the satirical importance of this event.
But I suppose at that point, that was the first time you worked together with them? Or was that...
Well, sort of professionally. I mean, I knew them very well from university because we used to do these sort of Sunday night new material evenings every fortnight. And then they did Oxford Review, I think the year after I did. So I kind of knew them, but it was the first time actually, I suppose, working directly with them.
And you're all like learning satire a bit because like when people think of you now, they obviously think of your vast body of work as a satirist. But obviously you had to start somewhere. So obviously, how old are you when this was happening then?
Oh, this would be about, 23, 24?
So this is when you were just learning it anyway. So I guess getting that level of feedback was obviously quite useful in the sense of learning.
Yeah, but also there's lots of great things about radio. One is, you know, the fast turnaround thing. The you write it that day, you record it that day, and it goes out that night or the next. There was, and I remember doing a very early news quiz where it was all put on a tape and you only had one copy of it. And it goes out at 6:30 and it was 5 to 6 and I had finished it. And you have to take it to the, it's probably all different now at the time, you take it to the gramophone library and it's shut. And there's just a sign saying, if we're closed, just drop it through this letterbox. So you drop this tape, you know, this spool of tape through a letterbox. You just see it thud onto the floor thinking, well, I don't know what happens now. It's meant to go out in 35 minutes. And you'd go home and sure enough, someone had come in and found it and put it on. Yeah, so there's the immediacy of it, which is great. There's really something exciting about that, writing something and then hearing it going out. But the other thing about radio is, you know, it teaches you economy. It teaches you, you know, every word is important. If you faff around and just write screeds and screeds and screeds of stuff, you know, just by looking at it, that it's too long. And it forces you to pare it down. And also because that's all you do have. You can't get round it with a colourful costume or a, you know, whatever. It really forces you to think about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I like podcasting, is that I have to sit down and I listen to this. I'll be listening to this like 3 or 4 times over just to make sure that everything in it, I think, is worth it being in it. And I'm not saying that you're waffling or anything. It's just a case of editing.
But just to help you along, I will waffle every now and then just to kind of keep you on your toes.
I might add in clap breaks. But I know what you mean, and I read a thing about how you did, I don't want to get this wrong, 17th century religious language.
Yeah, I did a PhD. I was at university for 6 years. I did undergraduate. Yeah. I stayed on and did research. And it was in my postgraduate years that actually that's when I wrote lots of comedy. And that's when Lee and Herring were around and Al Murray as a sort of undergraduates. And David Schneider, I performed with it.
Did you find, because obviously apparently you left that, but I mean, did you find that learning those languages helped with writing with like colourful and vivid stuff in satire?
No, I suppose it was more maybe doing an English degree, you know, when you analyse language in detail and you look at good writing and you try and work out what makes it work. I suppose there is that subliminally that you pick up that interest in in seeing how something can work verbally. And also you pick up different styles, so therefore different voices. And you know, and but I always loved people who themselves were very good at analyzing. I mean, George Orwell writing about political language is great. It's fantastic. It's worth, he did a whole essay on politics in the English language that is still absolutely relevant today. It's just about how you can abuse metaphor, how you can say one thing but mean the other, how you can say nothing but make it sound impressive and all that. So I suppose that was useful, but that's not, I mean, I didn't do that as a degree thinking this will get me into comedy. It's just, you know, I was always a keen reader and I just loved reading. And right up till, you know, A-levels, I didn't know whether it was going to be arts or sciences. I did maths as well as English. And I, you know, I didn't really, and it was just, I think because in the end I thought, but I love this. I love reading. I love talking about literature and I love looking at writing. So that's the way to go.
Yeah, and I read a really good quote that said that you are the sum of the, so you're the average of the five people you hang out with most.
Right.
And so I suppose that also comes into the content you take in, because like you said, when you were reading all the papers.
Who said that?
I can't remember.
No, that's a very good
It's one. A really good quote, yeah, though, isn't it? Yeah, it's made me pick who I hang out with a lot.
Yeah.
A lot more specific.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's true, because like, if you're reading all
I
the papers.
I hang out with a serial killer, a nun. And
it's not
a Labrador.
So I should say there's one other person in the room, and I did worry because my back is to you right now. When he said serial killer,
and I thought he was with you.
I scuttled out of the window.
He's my assistant.
Assistant.
Yes.
Okay. That's not an accomplice. That's just definitely assistant.
Assistant.
Okay.
Yes.
Fair enough.
No, we don't socialise. I know nothing about him.
He could be doing anything in his free time.
I don't know. I don't know what he gets up to.
Okay.
Outside this office.
Or in this office, apparently. Well, because I remember you. Well, I don't remember. I wasn't around at that time. But
yeah.
you obviously moved on the hour to TV, and it became the day to day.
Yes.
And given that you loved radio that much,
yeah.
and you hadn't really had much experience or any, as I understand it, experience in TV at that point, how was transitioning that? Because obviously it's got to become visual now and everything.
Yeah. I mean, that was scary. And myself and Chris Morris, we were in exactly the same boat. I mean, Chris, similar sort of trajectory in that he was a big radio lover. He was a radio live radio presenter, fooled around with radio voices and made very rich audio comedy. So for both of us, it was a huge and slightly frightening and daunting task. But I think that's why, I mean, what it meant was doing the day-to-day meant that not only were we transferring the show to television, but we were doing a kind of parody of television news while at the same time working out how to make television. And that was probably quite good, because it meant, you know, we had an idea in our head about what we wanted to see, and we weren't so ingrained in, well, this is the way you make it, so you should make it like this. We were kind of slightly naive about how you make it. So I remember, for example, wanting to do the CNN type stuff as if down a satellite, and just thinking, well, the best way to make it is a certain type of camera, but then turn all the color up and then just degrade it afterwards, just dump it onto a videotape and then dump it onto another videotape and keep dumping it until it degrades. And I remember in the, you know, the post-production where they have all this highly expensive, sophisticated equipment, they were trying to get us to just use that equipment to give it the look. And in the end, the cheap, just dumping it onto cheap, nasty videotape that we'd sort of slightly spooled out and trodden on and looped, spooled back in was, you know, and we wouldn't have done that if we'd actually grown up kind of learning TV techniques, I suppose.
Yeah, I do a vlog, and in my vlog, I wanted to make one of the shots that I really spent ages on look a bit worn, and so I exported it, and then I exported it, and it's basically the same thing, because I thought it would be a digital thing, so it wouldn't grade, but it does, because it obviously compresses and moves it around and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's really, nothing changes, it's just
No, I know, it's just, and it's sort of thing, that's sort of obvious, really.
Yeah.
So do it, and like, if we wanted to do a 1950s style thing, we would go to the National Museum of Television, Brad, and borrow one of their cameras from the 1950s, TV cameras, and just film with that, because that's how you're going to achieve the look.
I suppose because you were working on the BBC, you had sort of, not more licensing, but or maybe you didn't have more
You did at the time. And also a lot of stuff at the BBC, although we were working for an indie with Talkback, a lot of the BBC television centre was very, there was a lot of stuff in-house all bunched together. So there was, you know, recording studios, TV studios, post-production suites, other sets, costume, you know, so it was like a big playpen where you could just pull stuff out and muck about with it.
It doesn't sound like you wanted it to go to TV, though, given the love for radio. Or was that the
intent? No, there was a not a reluctance. There was just a concern. But we thought, you know, well, let's go for it. But what we wanted to make sure was that it was just as good and that we worked just as hard on it. So we thought what we won't do is use any of the material from the radio show. We'll start again. And we'll spend a lot of time. I mean, Chris and I went on a radio news training course that the BBC arranged for us. And that was really interesting because it was actually... We actually learned how to put together television news bulletins. And it was at the time of the war of Bosnia. And they said, look, here's, you know, 40 minutes of unedited rushes of street in Bosnia, some incident. You've got 3 hours to cut that together into a package, 1 minute long, with these three facts. And you worked on it. And what we both realized was that we didn't have any pictures that went with one of the three facts. So what you do is the clock is ticking, time's running out, you just get rid of the fact. So in the end, you've got stuff to illustrate two facts. And the third fact didn't get mentioned because there are no pictures. And that was a real learning curve in appreciating how television is picture-led, it's picture-driven. And also, what you see on television is an edit. You know, the news isn't a neutral, unfiltered. It's somebody's editorial decision as to what to put as the first topic, second, third, and how they will cut it together.
I was chatting to Jonathan Pye for this actually a little while ago. You know, the satirist, the news reporter. We were talking about how I get really annoyed when people forget that newspapers are there to sell papers. Yeah. They don't actually have an obligation to inform you. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing I picked up doing the news quiz, because then I would read every newspaper, and as a result, you then can't read a single newspaper again because you know it's not the whole picture. And to this day, we still get at home, we still get The Guardian and The Telegraph. And it's quite funny because The Telegraph is very good comparing the two, because the front pages, The Telegraph always somehow manages to contrive to have a picture of a young, pretty woman on the front page, even though under the photograph it says, you know, sister of the man who died yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas The Guardian usually has like a dead animal or coal or something, you know, or Jeremy Corbyn looking depressed. And it's interesting just comparing it to. But you kind of read them knowing that you're not getting the whole picture. Actually, what you're getting is, and that's not to say they're corrupt. It's just to say it's just one group of people's take on what they see as the priorities of the day, and also what will drive their sort of audience to them that day.
Yeah. I mean, it's like saying, oh, I don't do enough jokes on cats because, you know, I do enough on dogs. Why don't I do enough on cats? I need to keep it even. And it's like, no. I'm only interested in talking about dogs. Yes. So as a result, I will do jokes about dogs.
Dogs are inherently more interesting.
They are way better than cats.
Yeah, no, I'm glad that you said that. Cats are kind of fair. I mean, dogs are stupid, but in a sort of amiable way.
But they're useful when they want to be. If you train them. Cats, you can't train.
No. Cats are, I don't know, they're up to something.
Cats are dogs that don't give a fuck. Cats... Like, cats are the worst. I used to have one, not my choice. But long story. You had a full-time job, essentially, as a radio producer.
Yeah.
And I suppose now, are you more freelance than...
Yeah. That was... I mean, I kind of left, after about a year and a half, I left as a staff producer. I got on the first rung of BBC management. I became the script editor, which it was the department script editor. So basically, the person in charge of looking for new ideas, new material, you know, nurturing writers, developing ideas and so on. But it then meant I had to go to kind of interdepartmental BBC management meetings. I remember the time I got the job and Jonathan James Moore, who was the head of the department, sort of congratulated me, and he sort of shook my hand. And as he shook my hand, four other people in suits kind of emerged. I don't know where they were hiding, but they kind of emerged and opened up some whiskey and we had a drink. And I suddenly felt like I'd aged 25 years and put on a lot of weight. And, you know, I just suddenly I felt uneasy, and I didn't last. I lasted about 3 months in that job because I just thought, this is not for me. I want to be doing my own things. I don't want to be spending a lot of time saying mostly no to other writers about their ideas, and I don't want to be going to BBC meetings defending programs that I think are a bit crap and being frustrated that things that I've seen that I think are really good are not getting on. I just couldn't really cope. And it was about the time that On the Hour was going out, and Knowing Me, Knowing You was going out. So we knew, you know, there were approaches from television to go and make it on television.
Taking forward the analogy of the papers and how they they pick and choose what they do.
Yeah.
Obviously, TV channels are the same except for in a visual medium.
Yeah.
So I suppose my question would be, if you were making, if you wanted to just make stuff that you wanted to make that was good, how did you know that it was going to be not TV worthy, but they were going to want to even put it on, other than the stuff that had already been commissioned? So we're talking about future projects.
Well, you do, the danger is you think like that. You know, I mean, I remember going freelance and thinking, if I think too hard about this, I'll be very scared, because I'm, other than this TV pilot that I've been asked to do, I've no idea what the future holds. But I knew there was interest in the day-to-day and in Knowing Me, Knowing You with Alan Partridge. So I knew, well, I've got two TV pilots. One of them might be lucky and get a TV show. But yeah, you do make that leap thinking, I'm leaving behind the security, the, you know, the 9-to-5 nature, 5 days a week, you know, the BBC pension, all that. I'm leaving all that behind. But, you know, I would be 25, 26 then? Oh, no, maybe a bit, 26, 27. You know, I think at that age, you still, I'm speaking for myself, but I was relatively optimistic. I had enough belief that I could come up with something, but I had no idea how it would go or, you know, where it would take me to. So there wasn't a grand plan, really, other than making those shows and seeing what happened.
Did you, so let's zoom back to when you're 26, 27.
Yeah.
You've left your job.
Yes.
You're going freelance.
Yes.
You've obviously got some stuff you're working on in the pipeline.
Yeah.
But day one, freelance.
Yeah.
Did you have a part-time job to go to, or is it just immediately
what's going on? And not only that, but actually, I think it was the BBC asked me to make the day-to-day. And after a while, we turned them down because we just thought, well, I know, yes, they wanted to make the day-to-day, but I couldn't produce it. A TV producer would produce it. And Chris and I just thought, that's not, no, we need to be in charge. So Sona, and then Hattrick approached us and said, we would like to make the day-to-day. And we turned them down as well. which was the scary bit. And, you know, Hattrick are great. And, you know, they're all great. Jimmy Bulver was very welcoming. We just thought it wasn't the right fit. I mean, we must have been real quite arrogant bastards at the time, because we were kind of looking at all these kind of, you know, well-established comedy people and going, no. But I remember when we turned Hattrick down, that's where I was thinking, what the hell are we doing? Because, you know, we've got to do this. It'd be a shame if it never got made. Unfortunately, that was right. And then Talkback came along and said, look, we'd like to make the day-to-day. And they were really, Peter Fincham at Talkback was really really protective, able to argue for all the resources that we needed and the time, linked us up with Alan Yentop, who was the controller of BBC Two at the time, who, you know, loved the idea and was very supportive. So instantly we felt, okay, we've sort of found the right home and the right group of people. But again, because we wanted to make it right, we took a long time making the pilot, because we wanted to get it absolutely right. And then once we made the pilot, it's then another, you know, it takes another year to then make this show, because we were making it very slowly and very carefully.
Did you have, who did you go with in the end? Did you say?
Talkback.
So did you have Talkback in mind when you first thought we might do this for TV? Or was it a case of the way they approached you? Or
yeah, they approached us.
Okay.
I left the BBC thinking we're going to make the day-to-day for the BBC.
Right.
And then then we turned the BBC down. So it's I'm not sure now how we managed to kind of get through that without going mad. But I'm glad we did, because it kind of meant from early on, we kind of established among the, you know, TV fraternity that we wanted to be left alone and left in charge and, you know, do it our way. And I think that was quite good. I think it paid off in the end, because it meant that right from day one, we'd kind of said, it's either this or not at all.
See, that's really, I mean, I've not had the same conversations as you in that respect, but I've done things where I've said, because it's not going to be done the way I want it to be done, I'm going to walk away, I'm going to go and do it. Especially now there's the internet, I can do it
exactly.
myself. But I suppose you didn't have that luxury.
But I always, in every project I go into, I kind of work out what the bottom line is, you know, and as it gets bigger, and if you're doing a film, you know, there's more people involved and it's someone else's money, and you feel responsible for that. You can't, you know, just, you know, be very lax about it and, you know, spend it stupidly. I am aware there's a responsibility, but I always kind of work out, you know, editorially what's my bottom line. And therefore, if for some reason we cross that line, in my head, I've walked away. At that point, I've said to myself, that's when I can no longer do that, because it's gone below the point where I think this is how it should be made. And funny enough, that if you've worked it out and, you know, you're absolutely ready to do it, it rarely happens. Do you know what I mean? I think because you kind of give that vibe of, you know, roughly what, how you want to go about it. And also, you know, more often than not, people are supportive. You know, they do actually want to make good stuff on the whole. And fine, you know, I've had fun at, you know, TV executives' expense coming up with silly ideas and interference and stuff. But fundamentally, I think most people in the industry just want to make good stuff, really. So they are, you know, fundamentally, you know, they are supportive.
Yeah, I mean, when I spoke to Ian Coyle at Dave, and his his motive, his drive was, I really want good stuff. The problem is, sometimes I can't sell an advert on it. And Dave is a commercial station, so I need to sell an advert. And I get that, and I totally respect that. Because when you think about it like that, you're like, oh, he's not the dickhead commissioner who doesn't want to put my stuff on.
And that's why you get, you know, a whole succession of commissioners who do it for 2 or 3 years and then leave to become producers, because they've had to, you know, they want to do good stuff, but they've seen the good stuff or the quality affected by the pressures from ratings or adverts or whatever, slots, schedule and other. And there's only so many years you can, you know, manage that. And then after a while, you just want to go out and be creative yourself.
It's interesting, because if you look at the people you've named so far, so if we look at like Chris Morris and Stuart Lee and Richard Herring, all of them now still do that.
Yeah.
Where I mean, especially with Herring, with all of his online stuff.
Yeah.
Stuart Lee, who shunned a management, one of the biggest managements to just do his thing. So it's I think it's getting into that habit and routine early of standing your ground. Even if, like you said, you might have come off a bit of an arrogant 20-something, but I suppose it's put it out quite well. I mean, I'm sure there's hundreds it hasn't done, but...
Yeah, I mean, and I wouldn't encourage people starting to go around being very arrogant. It's just having a sort of an inner resolve as to what the secret is, to be really arrogant, and that will get you really far.
That's a soundbite I'm going to use.
I think it's just being a bit sure of like what it is you want to do. Now, that doesn't mean to say that if you do that, you will end up being successful, because, you know, chances are people go, well, he's been difficult. We're not going to do it, you know. And that's the kind of risk you take. But you're right, with being able to produce stuff yourself and put it online means that, you know, well, it means you don't have to wait for the call in terms of writing something or making something, because you can just go ahead and make it. And I think the more you write, the more you make, the better you get. And therefore, you know, the quality goes up. And then you have a back catalogue of stuff that you can then do something with if you want to take it any further.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's all well and good sitting around and just going, oh, they never ring. But it's like, why would they ring?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, the real dilemma is, how do you get paid? How do you make money out of it? That's the real...
As in online content?
Yeah.
I think if you... I mean, I'm an avid believer in this. I mean, I was telling you about my book before we started recording. I mean, I believe if you build enough of a connection with your audience, they'll want to help you keep making the thing they like.
Yeah.
So I firmly believe if you do a good enough job, someone in your audience will give you something towards... And obviously, as that builds... I mean, there's a website... Do you know Patreon.com?
Patreon, no.
It's a website where... if you wanted to sponsor like a podcast, for example, you could say a pound episode or whatever, and if you get enough of those, it's easy to do. So I suppose there are models that are building that are meant to be making it easier for you know the online
community. And I've always been a believer that, you know, good stuff will be found out, you know, good stuff, you know, because word of mouth and you know, it tops the way.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were writing with Chris Morris to get the transfer from the On the Hour to the day to day, essentially. Yeah. And what was that like? Did you bring ideas together? Did you work separately?
Yeah, it was a bit of both. I mean, for On the Hour, we would sit down, and it was a whole team of writers, but Chris and I would sit down together and work out the shape of a show, what the theme would be, what topics would come up. I'd be having separate conversations on some of with the cast in terms of, and the other writers in terms of some of the inserts. But if we decided to be like a big theme like this week, we're going to cover, you know, an earthquake, Chris would then go off and just make his stuff all related to that and then bring it in. And then we'd work out how those bits would slot in with the rest of the show. And then together we'd sit down and weave a kind of structure to that program and then spend a day in the studio with all the separate bits ready to be played in and just spend the day recording his presenter, his links. So it was a very sort of organic approach, really. And that was more, I mean, you have to slightly formalize it when you go into television because suddenly everything, you know, just takes longer and needs more resources. So
costs more.
Yeah. So you have to kind of, you know, flesh it out a little bit more in advance and try and work out whether we are going to make that or which of these seven ideas are the ones we're going to go with before we, you know, go off and commit. So there was just, working that out took a little while, but fundamentally it was, in the end, it was the same sort of relationship. You know, Chris would do his stuff. I'd be around to watch it, you know, whereas when he was doing his radio stuff, he could just break into Danny Baker's studio at night and record his stuff. And, you know, radio's easy to do that. It's very, you know, you can do it on your own. Whereas television involves so many other people. So I'd be around to kind of watch Chris do his stuff. And then he'd come and watch if I was out with the rest of the team doing, you know, Backstreet Dentists or whatever, Medieval Hospital or, you know, the American news reports and so on. And then, you know, in the edit, we'd kind of same thing. We, you know, and then we'd do these big long days in the studio. We'd build the studio, which again would be much more elaborate because, you know, again, in a radio studio, it's just microphones. Mm. Whereas a TV studio, you know, where is Alan Partridge in relation to Chris Morris? And where is the business desk? And what happens when a war breaks out? How do we move the desk? How do we turn the set into a war set? And things like that, which were enormous fun to work out, but take more time. So it's more, you know, it's almost like I imagine doing an animation. You know, you're working out all the mechanics of it in advance before you actually go in and do it.
Yeah, we're talking about Rob Popper as well.
Yeah.
He really taught me. So, like I said, the vlog for me, the end point is I want to make a sitcom and I want to learn how to film it myself. Yes. So I thought I'd learn this way. And something he taught me was, first of all, lighting, moving those around are a pain.
Yes.
So schedule out your shots. And having a shot list for a vlog, it seems a bit over the top, but it makes your life a billion times easier.
Well, the more you plan, and that doesn't mean to say you have to make the whole thing robotic, but more you plan, the more you can iron out stuff in advance. Mm. I mean, something like The Thick of It was born out of the fact we had very little money and I wanted to shoot quite a lot. Mm. So we found a set of disused offices and Jamie Kearney, the DOP, I said, can we just light it generally? Just write the whole thing so we don't have to stop to relight. And that way we can run from one office to another and follow them on the cameras and not really have to stop to kind of reposition everything and so on. But you can only do that. You get a certain look doing it like that, which doesn't apply. You couldn't do like, you know, a glossy costume drama like that because, you know, it just won't work, you know.
And you've got to have like, I mean, as the day moves on.
And, you know, and the horses get tired, you know.
Bloody horses.
Horses.
I can't remember the last time you've worked with a horse, so I suppose.
We had a horse on the first episode of Knowing Me, Knowing You on telly.
Right.
And it did shit on the stage. So we kept that bit in, as you do. Horses. I did Racist Police Horses in Channel 4 show. Yeah, I like horses.
You like horses?
Yeah.
So it sounded like you were very anti-horse but pro-dog so far. No.
One day all television will be just horses. It'll be,
yeah, but that's when the meteor strikes and we all die. And they take over the network.
And the horses rise up.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
That's the dream.
Yeah.
Nightmare. I mean, you're known for your satire as a general. So if someone were to say, what are you? Most people would go satire. But obviously you did the Amanda Minucci show.
Yes.
It was like one of your first things.
Yes.
And on episode one of that, and it was a bit more personal that.
Yes.
And on the first episode, you talked about faking it and feeling like you were muddling through. And even as we're talking now, you're saying things that reflect that. Like when you said that you, when you were in 23, 24, 25, and you were sort of like, what am I doing? I'm leaving a great job. Given you've got a lot of accolades now, and given that you essentially have an audience who, for better or for worse, maybe a sycophant or member of the audience, a section of the audience that would just follow you anyway, do you still feel like you're muddling, or do you still feel like
I still feel that one day I'll be found out. But I think it's more to do with...
That makes you sound like you and him are doing something again.
Like. I'm just kidding. No, I'm kind of more confident about the stuff that I'm doing. Whereas when I started, I just thought, is this funny? I think it's funny, and they think it's funny, the people I'm working with. But is it funny or do they, I always worried that people I was working with thought I didn't really know what I was doing, you know, and I think everyone has that. I think I've kind of gone through that and accepted. I kind of probably do know what I'm doing, but with every new project, I think, but this could be the one that's completely shit, and I won't really, and I won't really know that until we make it, which is scary. So I still get, you know, not petrified, but I still get that, you know, there's that uncertainty, but I'd rather have that than be making the same thing again and again and again. That's the thing. But there is always that, okay, well, I'll make this, but this could be awful. This could be, people might just go, oh my God, what was he doing? And actually, in retrospect, all his other stuff is shit too.
Yeah, no, I know that feeling.
A kind of chain critical reaction that obliterates all your previous work.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Do you think you're addicted to the cycle of that in a way? Because obviously it drives you to make the next thing.
Well, I have a kind of slightly fidgety, you know, if I've done something, even though if I've enjoyed it, the next thing I want to be slightly the opposite of what I've just done. So, you know, if I've just spent 5 years doing an American TV show, you know, about American politics. So after that, I went to do a European movie that has some American actors in it, but I didn't have to deal, you know, I didn't have to commute to the East Coast or the West Coast of America in order to do it. And that was, it's just a sort of reaction to the last thing, just to kind of keep, I just want to keep being interested. So I have to generate stuff that will interest me. And that invariably means something a little bit different from the last thing I did.
Yeah, totally. I think everyone feels like they're faking it. I'm not faking it, but I suppose, yeah. I mean, I have a joke in my new show about how if I'm in a conversation with too many people, I sometimes worry that the adults are going to realize they're talking to me.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Like, David Schneider and I always call them the tall people.
The tall people?
The tall people. The people who you always think are, even though they're younger than you,
yeah, yeah,
feel a bit older and a bit more responsible.
Yeah. I think it's because they've got the jargon down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The office jargon.
Kind of act grown up, and I never feel grown up, even though I'm, you know, 52 now. I still feel like I'm kind of still a student, really.
Yeah, and I think as a stand, I do stand up mainly, but as a stand up, you live a perpetual student existence.
Well, yeah, it's that. But also, it's that thing of, it's probably why I left the BBC after 3 months, because this part of me just felt, I can't do this. I can't be at a desk in an office for the next 25 years. I don't want to know what I'm doing in 5 years' time. That's the thing. I don't have a.
That was the next question I was going to ask. What you're going to do in 5 years?
What am I going to do in 5 years? Yeah. No, I don't know. Because I hate that, you know, sort of being boxed in, you know, and it was, and the most difficult thing I've done has been Veep for that very reason, because, you know, in America, it's like you do a show, if it gets on a big network, and HBO are fantastic, you're really expected to make it for 8 or 9 years, milk it for all it's worth, and then retire. That's the dream. But I just thought after 4 years of it, I felt, that's enough. Stop it now. Someone else can do it. I really like the show, fantastic cast and great project, and HBO are fantastic. Someone else can do it, but I might scream if I make any more, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I know the feeling. I can say this now, because by the time this comes out, my tour will be over. But okay. I've done this show now for nearly 2 years.
Well, that's enough.
I've done it over 100 times.
That's enough.
And I'm having to, every night now, go home and rehearse it, because I've forgotten it, because I've had a month and a half off of it. Yeah. And I'm bored of it.
Yeah.
But I love it, and I'm really proud of it. But I'm just like, and I just want to get started on the next one. And
that's why I like when Stuart does a TV series. He then does a show in which he performs all that material for the very last time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In one
yeah.
big show.
Which is, I mean, it's better life as well.
Yeah.
Which is part of the beauty of it. I mean, what for you is the major difference between a writing room in London, well, not London, it's a very London-centric industry, but in the UK and in America?
I don't know, because, you know, Veep was a London writing room.
It was really?
Yeah, okay. we had an office over in Soho, and it was all the writers that I'd worked on the thick of it with, you know, a few writers I hadn't worked with before I came on board, but all UK writers, UK directors. We edit it in the UK. The cast came over to London every now and then to rehearse. So it was very much a British-based production. And then we'd go out to Baltimore to actually film it for 3 or 4 months. But it was... So actually, I don't know what a US writing room is like. I think there is now one on season 5 that's just gone, and season 6, because it's a US showrunner who's taken over. He lives in LA. The cast all live in LA. So the whole production's moved to LA. Makes more sense because that's where they all live. So it's an American, you know, writing room. But I have no experience of that. I have no idea how it works.
A lot of political stand-up in particular, as in like live stand-up.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how often you get to see live.
It's been ages, actually. It's just, again, you know, yeah. Doing my American show and stuff, when I was ever here, I was so jet lagged or in an edit that the idea of going out at night to see more comedy was just, I would relax just by watching depressing stuff, you know.
Oh, then you'd like my comedy.
Or just staring at a wall, you know. Or maybe at a cat.
Yeah, they are depressing.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask about, because a lot of comedy, I'm not saying all, but a lot of it is around mocking the look of a politician, or even on the kind of, you know, their name or something like that. Yeah. And sorry, I've just interrupted you. What were you going to say?
No. Well, I've always felt, you know, when we did things like Friday Night Armistice, we try to avoid, he's funny, he talks like this, and more, he said that, but he did this. That doesn't make any sense. Or, you know, here's her argument, and yet this is what she did last week. You know, looking at argument or looking at what people do. Also, I mean, I hate labels and labeling anyway. So yeah, it used to really annoy me that people made fun of John Prescott because of his sort of mangled sentences. And I just thought, well, that's not important. What's important is, like, why did he agree to the Iraq war when clearly he was against it? You know, that's more important.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose what's been really interesting for me to watch, especially as, Cameron with the pig's head issue.
Yes.
And Charlie Brooker wrote an episode of Black Mirror to do with it. And obviously there's been parallels in loads of things from a while ago. I mean... I've tried to write political stand-up, but I find it hard because it feels like they're doing it for me.
Well, we're sort of being outpaced. And I think it is, there's now a whole generation of politicians who've grown up watching political satire.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's people like Malcolm Tucker, I've always regarded as just a bastard. And yet in politics, they think he's the sort of the gold standard that, you know, as a political fixer, you should be aiming for. And that's depressing. But also, I think, you know, politicians have become more media savvy and, you know, recruit writers to write them jokes or things to go viral or things that might become a meme. You know, they're sort of hyper conscious of that media filter that everything goes through, and therefore it's no surprise that the things they end up doing seem to echo the fiction that other people have come up with.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel, I don't know if you ever think about this when you're writing or the other end, where, because I suppose in the writing process it's hard to think of whether satire would have an impact on people's actual opinions or
well
views.
I don't think it does in that. Okay. I mean, I never make anything thinking, oh, this will change people's views, because I don't think it's going to happen. It might crystallize a thought that you have, or it might help you articulate something that's been, you know, half formed, bubbling in your head as an argument or as a concern. But I don't think it does anything other than that. It might confirm something that you've always felt about someone or an argument or something. But other than that, it's entertainment, and it's a kind of personal response to what you're seeing around you. But I think it's dangerous to think that it's anything bigger than that.
Do you find you get more, because obviously you're on social media, and the immediacy of the response you can get from that is almost as you've said it, someone can tweet you. So do you find you get a lot of hate or a lot of support when you say something?
No, I rarely get trolled. I'm trying to think when. No, it's, yeah, I've managed to stay out of it. Occasionally when I say something about Trump, I get the old American Trump supporter just tweeting very loudly. Lots of capitals. You asshole! You know, that sort of thing. But that's about it, really.
It was Phil Jupitus said something that really helped me out with trolls, where he said, just because it's written in the same font as something someone said that's clever doesn't mean you should take it as seriously.
Well, that is the big problem with the entire internet, in that it all looks official.
Yeah.
Because it's all typed up. So the comments under a column are given the same critical value as the column.
Mm.
And you think, no, that's just, you know, that's just some of millions of people out there saying something. It's not someone whose job it is to be paid on a weekly basis by a newspaper or journal to come up with a set of arguments on a particular topic. But the problem is, I think it's easy to see something just because it's up on a web page as, you know, formally important.
Expanding on the idea of, does satire actually make any difference? I suppose as you evolve and as you change the person, and maybe your political beliefs and who you are changes, I suppose that'll have an impact on your writing and how you produce something, but I suppose it won't have a necessarily impact on the people that support you. So, for example, you got knighthood, and I was wondering, you got a...
That would be extraordinary.
Wrong one. So you got an OBE.
Yeah.
Let me do that again. I'm not leaving that in. There's no way I'm leaving that in.
No, you've got to.
Why? Oh, God, fine. Okay, I'm leaving it in because... Because you asked. Only because you're not laughing. Is David Schneider will listen to that and go, he's going to say, I've got a knighthood next. Like, he'll just say, everyone's got a knighthood.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Ed, why not? No, but you got an OBE.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether you felt like that has changed your ability to undermine the establishment, or whether it's...
No, I mean... Well, I mean, it goes, you keep saying satire, and I've never really regarded myself as a kind of, you know, political satirist in terms of this image that I can see people have, but I just don't think it's true, that all I'm interested in is undermining the political establishment. I'm really not. I'm so fascinated by politics. I love politics. I want people to engage in politics. And I often think in the thick of it, it's actually the minister I feel most sorry for. You know, they're only trying to do something. It's the circumstance that they end up in, or the pressure put on them by the media and their advisors and, you know, Malcolm and their own vulnerabilities that pushes them in. So I'm not a kind of all politicians are terrible pieces of work. I just don't think that at all. In terms of the OBE, I knew when the letter arrived saying you've been nominated for an OBE, do you want? I thought, just this is either going to be terrible or hilarious. I can't decide which. And, you know, part of me said I should just ignore this. Another part of me said, what happens if I say yes? And I just on the day, the let's see what happens kind of button just won out. And it was kind of, it was really interesting, really. And it was an interesting day. We had a really good time, but it was, I mean, I felt actually quite small when I ended up there, because it was like, what are you here for? Oh, I saved three men from a, you know, fire. Oh, okay. What are you here for? I did some comedy. So I did feel small at time, but that's it. You know, I don't see it as something that, you know, I never use it. I never put it, you know, it's just a,
It's not your website.
It's not my website. And and it's interesting when you talk to other people who come from sort of immigrant families who have received a kind of an honor. It's funny, they're particularly sort of proud of it, because you grow up I mean, my parents in particular grew up in a kind of, you know, are we part of the UK? Are we not? Are we separate? Are we? So there is something that it's almost like a piece of paper that you can hold up going, do you see? I'm actually British. Do you see? Do you understand now? Which is kind of good. And also I do think, you know, I'm happy to accept awards and prizes and on it. I'm pleased if the work gets recognition. But what I did think is I can't no stop. I've actually got to make things even better if I can. You know, so that's the kind of the thing that, you know, that does drive you.
Definitely. And yeah. And in terms of, because there's a lot of awards now for like TV and for radio.
I know. And it's an endless cycle. It's funny when you do films or when you do American shows, you know, the award season is continuous. Mm. And I don't think there's any other career where you would congratulate yourself so much for what you do.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, no, I wondered if you thought there were too many, but it sounds like you think there is.
There are. And I've kind of stopped going to them now, really, because there isn't, you know, there's just too much. And I think it's great, actually, when you're starting off and you get that first. I mean, there's nothing more exciting than going to your first awards or going to the BAFTAs for the first time or the Comedy Awards for the first time, or when we did Veep, going to the Emmys for the first time or... And, you know, the Oscars it's really fun. It's fun. But then there comes a point where you think, I remember going to the BAFTAs a couple of years back for the Thick of It, the last series of Thick of It. And I was so tired because I just got back from America and I was jet lagged. And I felt I ought to go. It'd be churlish not to go. But I knew we weren't going to win because we won it the previous, you know, it just wasn't going to happen. But I just thought it'd just be rude to kind of stay at home. I'm above all. So I went. And I didn't realise that the camera had picked me up looking really morose. And I think what they did is when they cut that shot up, when they announced that the winner was, I think it was 2012 or, you know, it wasn't the Thick of It. And somebody said they saw the next day in one of the papers, you know, the award for sorest loser goes to Armani Nucci for this look. And there was a screen grab of me just looking absolutely. And all it was, I'm just tired.
Yeah. But you've got to always be on at those things because
I know. I mean, that's supposed to come up. I mean, it sounds dreadful. I mean, it's like it's not, you know, talk about first world problems. You know, oh, too many awards to go to. It's not that. It's just I think they're good for, you know, really projecting new stuff and bringing new people to attention and good quality work being recognised. I think that's great. I kind of, you know, always happy to be nominated, you know, but you do eventually realise there's just so many of them.
And to talk about your management for a second, you're with PBJ.
Yeah.
And you've been with them the whole
for
time?
For ages, yeah. Right.
Do you remember when you signed with them? Do you, how old were you when that?
Well, I was still at radio, so I was making that kind of, that jump about to go freelance. So, and they looked after Chris Morris, so they kind of knew me, and so it was an easy, you know, it was an easy thing to do. And they're great. I mean, Peter Bennett-Jones has been a kind of, you know, he's done 101 things. He looks after all these comedians, but he's been running Comic Relief and all sorts, you know. And he's also fundamentally decent. You know, I wanted an agent that wasn't, you know, having been a producer, so having been in the other side of these phone calls, I've seen calls, you know, controllers pick up a call channel controller's phone going and their assistant saying it's X on the phone and them saying, oh God, no, tell I'm not around. I didn't want my agent to be that person who provoked that kind of response.
Yeah, nobody does.
So, no.
And how old you were when you signed with them?
I must have been about 26, 27, something like that. I mean, I could have this completely wrong, but I think I'm about that.
Well, yeah. I'm only painting the picture a bit for people. Because now PBJ are obviously one of the biggest agents in the country. And I'm imagining back then they were not as big as they were.
Still, I mean, they looked after Rowan Atkinson and Eddie Izzard. And you know, Chris, Harry Enfield, you know,
and I suppose as their client base has grown up, they've grown up and stuff. And I just wondered how you'd pick to go with them over, or was it just they were offered at the time because they were with Chris, and so you didn't.
They just seemed the right fit, to be honest. And you know, Peter, PBJ Management, he looks after specifically people who create their own work. So Eddie Izzard, Lenny Henry, Tim Minchin, you know. Not so they don't have a huge roster of sort of actors. It's more people who create their own projects because they find that interesting to do, to manage.
Yeah. And at this stage in your career, where you are, I don't want to say a banker, because, in TV terms, as in, it's like...
I thought you meant a kind of like a financial kind of...
I heard myself say it, but it doesn't make any sense.
Hedge fund kind of...
Well, it's like Will Smith in films, you know, they would say that you put him in, he's one of the most bankable acts in that respect. I mean, I would put you down as one of the bankable writers in the country or producers.
Although, I mean, I've never got huge audiences. It's sort of, you know, anything on BBC Two has always been, you know, it's not been up there with Miranda and Little Britain and, you know, Gavin and Stacey. It's kind of small but enthusiastic.
Did you get more audience on radio than TV?
I don't know. I don't know what figures are on radio, actually. Okay. You don't as a kind of... As a habit, you don't ask, you know, whereas in television, it was always, you know, what was the overnights? What were the figures? How are we doing? Because television is a bit more ratings driven. On radio, you're not that, you know, you're not affected by ratings so much. I mean, I suppose the whole channel is, but not the individual programs.
Yeah, definitely. No, I was only wondering if, and obviously, if you feel like you need an agent at this stage, if they still provide you what they originally provided you, if that's changed as you've...
Yeah, I mean, you certainly need management. I mean, I find, especially when you're dealing, you know, if you're dealing with like a film studio or if you're dealing with, you know, a network like HBO, and also television is changing so much, it's so fluid, and everything is a co-production now anyway. I think you do need someone who, you know, has a brain for processing whether that's a good thing to be doing and that's a good deal to be had. And also, the creative terms of what you want, so there's nothing buried in all of that that means you don't want to have the final say, or, you know, you're not expected to do this and that sort of thing. So it's utterly invaluable, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And you've obviously done a lot for the BBC and a lot for commercial stations.
Yes.
And I wondered whether you've seen a change in the way they commission stuff, especially in the style that you do, whether that's affected you or whether it's just the way that TVs and the audience are changing.
I think generally commissioning, maybe over the last 10 years, has got a bit more, you know, risk averse. And therefore, you know, I was lucky. The day-to-day was basically Alan Yentob saying, yeah, I like that, let's do it. Even the thick of it was Rolly Keating at BBC Four when it just started saying, I like that idea. We don't have very much money. What can you do for this amount of money? I think I may be wrong, but I get the feeling it's a little bit more... Comedy is expensive. That's the thing. You know, it is expensive. It's expensive to pay for writing. It's expensive to pay for actors, sets, production. It's a big number. So therefore, if it doesn't get an audience... Technically, officially, you've wasted a lot of money. Mm. So therefore, people who decide what should go on or what should be commissioned, you know, even though they want to make good stuff, there is part of them thinking, but I mustn't get this wrong. And oh dear, that slightly concerns me. Maybe I should ask for another rewrite on that before we come to a decision. Or maybe I should just put it to one side for 6 months and then see what else we're making before I come back to that, you know. So I've feel that process of getting stuff on is a little bit slower and a bit harder. Just as, actually, British television is now having to compete with your Amazons and your Netflix and, you know, an American TV, HBO and so on, which we can now access at any time. You know, it's not like we can't now watch American TV. Yes, we can. Mm. You know, we can very easily watch it. So they're part of the British viewing culture. And, you know, my experience at HBO was... The opposite. It was very much, okay, we like this idea, we want to make it, you're in charge, let's make it. Very little interference, which was the sort of the BBC approach 15 years ago. And, you know, they've taken that model from the BBC and said, that's how we'll make stuff that's a bit different.
Do you think there are any stuff that you made 15 or 20 years ago that wouldn't get made now?
Well, you know, the day-to-day, I wonder whether that would quite have that tone, you know. Friday Night Armistice was a big budget production, and we were allowed to just run around at the BBC, use other TV programs to re-edit, and, you know, now it's just compliance and copyright, and that department shut down. There are no costumes anymore, so you can't, you know. We had this thing called Hunt the Old Woman, in which we put an old woman in other TV shows live, so she would turn up on Top of the Pops in the background, and you could only do that because you were in the same building as all those other shows. But now everything's sort of fragmented. That would be difficult. But then what you would do is you would come up with a new show in today's television, rather than think about whether the old show would get shown now.
You'd work around the limitations. Yeah, yeah, definitely. And that's part of the fun and the challenge.
Yeah, and it's also why people now do stuff on Virally and YouTube and whatever as another way of getting stuff done.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously you've collaborated with loads of what are now very big names. Mm. But obviously when you all started out, you were all just starting out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So how did you go about picking the people that
It was the show, really. It was on the hour and I wanted just lots of people who could act, who could do lots of characters, but who could perform naturalistically, do a little bit of improvising so that it sounded real. So I knew Rebecca Front. And in fact, as a radio producer, I'd done some shows with her on other stuff. I'd heard about Steve, so I watched Steve's stuff, got in touch with Steve. I heard Chris Morris on the radio doing exactly what it was I was hoping to do, so just got in touch with them. So they were all assembled for that show.
So in my head, I had news team assembled.
Yeah, but it wasn't like we all, you know, were a group of people at the same university or the same drama school or whatever and had done our stuff. It's just we all came together for that show and then we all hit it off, and therefore, you know, Peter Bainham was one of the writers on the in the radio corridor at BBC Radio, so he then came on board as one of the writers. Lee and Herring I knew, not just from university, but, you know, then doing Weekending and doing some more radio stuff with them. So it kind of all came together for that show, and then, you know, and then after the day-to-day, different combinations of those people have done other things.
Because obviously you said before where you were learning how to do stuff basically on the fly as you were doing it.
Yeah.
And I was told that when you were doing in the thick of it,
yeah,
you did some scenes were shot in multicam in two takes.
Yes.
Where you would do one scripted and one improvised. And I wondered if that's a technique that you did just because you were trying it out, or whether it's one you recommended and you always thought would work.
Well, we used to do a little bit in things like the day-to-day and any Partridge stuff. We always used to do little improvised rehearsals. So we'd write the script, but then workshop them in a little downstairs basement at Talkback. And on the basis of what came up in the improvisation, that would then get fed back into the script. And then when we were doing Iron Man and Partridge, we'd write the script and it'd be very heavily structured script for each episode. But we'd then spend a week in rehearsals with the hotel all laid out and his bedroom and the, you know, and we'd muck about basically with each scene just to see what else came up, and then that got fed into the script. So the thick of it was really an extension of that. It was very much, okay, we haven't got a week to rehearse every episode, you know, it's really low budget, let's get two cameras in, the lighting lit everywhere so we can run around. We'd spend a couple of days on each script improvising in rehearsals, but on set, because the cast were then comfortable with that technique, we'd shoot the script, and then if there was time, I'd say, okay, let's shoot it again, but just slightly loosen it up too, just to kind of dirty it up, just to make it sound like it's natural, the natural rhythms of speech, people speaking over each other, not quite finishing their sentences, you know, that sort of the stuttering, And we do that. Or if I felt, actually, now I hear the script back, that beat there isn't clear. So could you just talk about that bit for a while, just to see if it comes out a bit more? So that's what we do. And because there were always two cameras filming it, it meant in the edit, I could easily cut it, because there's nothing worse than somebody improvising something and then you say, could you improvise it all again? But this time we're going to do it in a tighter shot. Yeah. So we've got it on two sizes. So I can, if I need to chop it down, because naturally improvisation is always longer, so I need to try and cut it down and just get to the best bits. Having two cameras always shooting it meant that I've always got that, the ability to edit around anything. So that's what, so the technique is really there for the show. The show, for each show, you ask yourself, what is the best way, the most effective way to make this show? And I thought for the thick of it, it would be like this.
And I suppose, like you said, or like you implied, a lot of the stuff that you do, or a lot of stuff, the projects you do for a certain period of time, and then obviously get annoyed with it or bored with it, and you're sort of like, I'm done with this.
Yeah. Well, I'm just scared of it going off. Do you mean going off the boil?
Yeah.
So I'd rather, if I got it to a point where I'm really, really happy with it, I always think, right, that's where I should stop now.
Yeah. Do you think, because there's a lot of people who debate this point or whether, or they have different opinions, and I'd love to know what you think of whether comedy is of its time or whether it can be timeless essentially and be resurrected.
I think it's very difficult to know, really. Some things are and some things aren't. I watched Dr. Strangelove recently, which I've always been big in, you know, and it was really slow. It was really slow. And I watched The Great Dictator, Charlie Chaplin's movie about Hitler. Fantastic. So it's very, very difficult to know, really. Very difficult.
I suppose if you were to bring back a programme, if you pick a programme, you know, the Amanda Iannucci show or the Time Trumpet or whatever, I suppose if you were to bring it back, it would would be, first of all, is it something we can keep fresh and yes. not drive you mad? And then second of all, is there actually somebody who'd want to watch it?
Yeah.
Would that be your, how, or would you just go away and be like, can I?
I never really think about that. You do have to think about it more when you're making films, because, you know, they cost millions and somebody's wants, you're going to have to try and persuade someone to give you that money. So they'll always be thinking, okay, what's the audience? But I don't think you can ever, I never write something for a specific audience. I write something for what I think is funny or feels different or feels unusual. I hope that other people will feel the same. You know, I'm kind of wagering that enough people will feel the same, but I'm not going out sort of road testing it.
So when you start a new project, say you've had an idea in your head right now, would it be a case of you'd get up tomorrow and just be like, 9-5, I'm going to write? Or is it a case of you let it organically happen?
It sort of builds it. And also I do an awful lot very collaboratively. It's very rarely that I'm sitting down on my own writing something. Usually it's two or three people in a room and we're bashing ideas around, and I might ask them to go away and just very quickly put it all down, and then we'll meet up and I'll go through it kind of line by line, and you know, it's always stays fluid like that, really.
And moving stuff from one medium to another is obviously always a challenge, and it's something you've done really well over different things. And working with Kevin Daly and Mark Thomas on Loose Talk.
Oh, Kevin Day.
Kevin Day.
Yeah.
Doing that game.
No, keep that in.
Should we just keep in all my fuck ups and we'll edit it to your... No, it's fine. No, we'll keep it in. To be fair, there'll be a percentage in this audience who won't know that was a fuck up, so we'll be fine.
Okay.
And they were talking about how moving Loose Talk from radio to TV wouldn't work. Mm. And do you think everything could essentially be moved if it had enough time and effort and thought to it?
Enough time and effort. I mean, they did try it on television and it sort of didn't quite take off. It ran for one series late at night and wasn't recommissioned. They've tried for decades to try and put Just a Minute on the television and it's never worked. Or even I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. You know, I think things are just meant to be as they are, and why tamper with them, really?
Yeah, some things and some things. Yeah. And have there been any TV or radio projects that you've turned down, rejected, or just not done because you've had to walk away and said, you know, they won't let me do it the way I wanted to, that you've regretted?
Yes, I'm just trying to think. It's usually things like there just hasn't been time. You know, you make something and then you realize you have to make it for 4 years. So there hasn't been time for that other thing that you wanted to make. You know, I would have liked to have done more Time Trumpet. I would like to have done more Amanda Iannucci shows. But, you know, the thick of it was happening at the same time. And then In the Loop and Veep happened. And Time Trumpet, the Amanda Iannucci shows were hugely time consuming. You know, they both took about a year and a half to make one set of six each. So it was things like that where you just think, I wish we could have gone back and done a bit more. I mean, we only made one series of The Day-to-Day, and it would have been nice to have done a second series. We did talk about it at one point, and, you know, we were getting into it, and then, you know, things happened. You know, Steve's doing this and Patrick's doing that and Chris has got this thing, you know, and I've got that, and, you know, and it, before you know it, 4 years have gone by. It's quite pleasing that somebody like Alan Partridge has sustained, and I think it's only because we only do Alan every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, you know? And I suppose that's you guys keeping it fresh for you, but also the audience.
Yeah, and we've kind of grown older as he's grown older, really.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose this is the weird one for me. It's like as performers and writers get older, they establish an audience base, or they establish a career. Some of them say there's a lot of freedom in that, because, you know, you have an audience and you have a certain bank of I keep talking about banking. You're probably looking at me going, am I wearing the wrong shirt? No, you know, they've got a bank of shows in the locker that they can say, look, I can do it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then some of them say that there's less risk you can take because obviously your audience wants a certain thing from you, or
and I'm also very aware of, you know, every 3 or 4 years there's a whole new generation of viewers who don't know who you are, or who are, you know, who maybe have seen the last thing you did but aren't aware of a thing you did 10 or 15 years ago. I'm very aware of that, how quickly. So I feel you have to keep sort of renewing your contact with the audience,
because it's very easy for me anyway to get into my own little bubble and worry that, you know, the thing I'm writing now isn't as good as the last thing or whatever. But I suppose if you kind of know there's a new audience every 3 or 4 years,
I mean, I'm not writing every new thing for the new audience. I think it's part of that thing of I don't want to keep doing the one show or the one thing, But and maybe subconsciously you're also aware that actually, well, that thing, you know, the thick of it, when was the last thick of it? It was about 3 or 4 years ago. There's probably a lot of people who are into comedy now who don't know what the thick of it is, you know. So you're actually starting afresh. When I come up with a new thing, you're kind of introducing yourself for the first time to a lot of people.
Do you find having back catalogue of, do you find a back catalogue of work ever causes you like writer's block when you're going to start a project because you're sort of like...
No, I'm not aware of it. I think it's nice to have it, and I kind of like the variety of it, but I'm not thinking, you know, when we start something, I never think, well, this has got to be as good as, you know, X. I just think this has got to be good. If it's not good, you know, if I'm putting my name to it, am I putting the work in? I want to be pleased with it. I don't want to be embarrassed by it, you know. And that's, you know, it's a perennial kind of paranoia that drives you, yeah. Which is, oh my God, this mustn't be shit.
Yeah, I think everyone listening to this can relate to that, regardless of what they do. And it's, and like you said, you're on social media and you're active on that. How would you describe?
Not as much as I used to be. I think when I started on Twitter, I was kind of like did 3 or 4 a day. Now I think a lot of people will say this, you kind of forget after a while. After you've done it for 4 or 5 years, you kind of go through whole days thinking, oh, I didn't really look at Twitter. I didn't, you know. I think that's their problem. I think they don't quite know how to, you know, expand it or monetize it without turning it into something that nobody wants it to be.
Yeah, an advertising platform.
Yeah. Just people don't want that, yeah. You know. And you've only got 140 characters, so you don't want to fill that with adverts.
No.
I still get that thing of like, hey, I had a really great Nescafe this morning. What? Why is, you know, paid content, you know. Do you remember somebody saying, was it Heathrow Airport? Heathrow Airport would love you to tweet happy birthday Heathrow Airport. They'll pay you.
You realise that now they should pay you for...
Because I've just said that. Yeah.
Do you want to beep it? It can be... Yeah.
I just thought, well, why? But what will people reading my tweets think of me going,
I'd unfollow.
Hey, happy birthday Heathrow Airport.
As someone who I write for those kind of brands, and what they want is they just want the acknowledgement that people now know they're on social media, so they might follow and they might take an interest in it. However, you know, I got on my suggestions, you know, it suggests like who can follow.
Yeah.
I had Donald Trump on there recently, which scared me and made me reconsider a lot of things. And then I had Charmin Toilet Roll. Now, I can't think of a chain of events that would make me want to follow Charmin on. I should get a sponsorship at this point.
But there is, you can see the connection with Trump. So, you know. So the algorithms had sort of done their work one level. Yeah.
Oh, for definite. Yeah. I mean, do you ever, like, do you engage with things like YouTube? Do you ever, like, watch or, like, look for new talent or anything like that?
I do. I mean, my kids point stuff my way.
Okay.
Usually Kane Peel, but, you know. Or, what's that? Guy who did Community. The cartoon.
Dan Harmon.
Yeah.
Oh, Rick and Morty.
Rick and Morty.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, the guy...
Sassy Trump. I've been recommending Sassy Trump to people. Trump. Peter Serovinovich just revoicing Donald Trump.
Really? That sounds...
Yeah. It's very funny.
Best voice.
Yeah, it's very funny. It's unedited.
Right.
He just revoiced him. So he's very... you know, I'm going to build a wall. Oh, this fella.
That sounds incredible.
Look at the size of him. You know, it's just really,
That's amazing.
Yeah.
No, the vlogger I'm watching a lot at the moment is called Casey Neistat, and he told me the reason he started was because he got a show on HBO and he did really well with it, but his kids were, like, he put his kid in it at one point and he said, don't you be embarrassed when I edit it and put you in it. And his son went, my friends don't watch that, they watch YouTube. And so he thought, well, 1 minute, I need the new base of audience. When we did
Mid-Morning Matters and it went up on YouTube, suddenly I was very cool with my son's kind of friends because I made original content for YouTube.
But that was Foster sponsored, wasn't it?
Foster sponsored it, and then so they had it on their webpage for a bit, and then, you know, after whatever it is, 30 days or something, it just goes up on YouTube.
No, I found that really an interesting move, because obviously Alan is not meant to be, like, not meant to not be successful, but he's not meant to be the He's meant to be this DJ who's sort of always thinks he's better than he is, and he's sort of never really. And yet now he's on a platform that, to me, doesn't. I at the time when I heard he was going to do it, I was, because it did a Chortle article, and I was like, how are they going to put him on YouTube? Because it doesn't feel like he should be on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I suppose, I mean, was that your original plan, or was it like?
We kind of wanted to get back and do some more Alan, and we wanted to, you know, really work harder and then just let it slip out and see what happened. Because, I mean, that was what, about 4 or 5 years ago now, I suppose. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, the original content wasn't huge at that time. It was just beginning to establish itself as a kind of outlet. And I think Steve and I, we just thought could be terrible, could be a disaster. We could put all this work into it and nobody sees it. Or, you know, and I just thought, well, let's try it. As long as we're happy with what we've made, let's just put it out there and see what happens.
Would you do any more YouTube-based content like that again? Or did you find...
Yeah, it depends what it is, though. Yeah. But you know, it was great fun. But we were lucky because, you know, he was a known commodity. So we were able to... And Foster's paid. So we were paid properly to make it and we had the resources to make it and all that. You know, which is different from someone just starting and it's an unknown and, you know.
I'm asking more if you like the medium itself rather than...
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I regret I never quite got around to doing was that idea of doing something where you're just making little things and just putting them out there and, you know.
Still time.
There still is, you know. People are very good at doing that sort of thing. You know, Adam Buxton does it and Peter does it and sort of, you know, I just haven't had a chance to kind of... And then you realise actually it's not as simple as that. You know, you've got to keep updating. You've got to keep refreshing. You can't just put something out and have it up there for like months on end. Mm. You know, people get annoyed if there's nothing new there. So you've got to, you know.
But your career, I don't want to say path because like you said, you didn't really have a plan, but your career history is doing so many different things in so many different mediums that, I mean, do you think it would have been viable for you to just have been, and I don't want to say it like just as in just, but for you to just do radio producing?
No, I mean, I didn't plan to go into television. I mean, it kind of happened because On the Hour and Alan Partridge just, you know, gained this sort of critical momentum. But I imagine I would have started getting fidgety after a while. After 4 or 5 years of radio, I would have wanted to do something else. And I also like writing and I like, you know, journalism and stuff like that. So I get, you know, I have a kind of, I'm always slightly thinking, you know, I'm enjoying the project, but I'm always thinking, what can I do that's different from this?
Yeah, totally. These are the last quick fire questions.
Yeah.
So they're quick fire for me, but you take as long as you like to answer them. So I ask every guest these. What are the best books on comedy, writing or stand-up that you've ever read?
Oh, heavens. I'm not sure I've read that many, to be honest.
Not even David's How to Write Everything.
I love comic writing. I love Woody Allen's pieces from The New Yorker.
Okay.
Side Effects and Without Feathers. I think that's where you learn, really.
Yeah, no, definitely. Mm. Oh, that's still the same counts, answer that counts. Yeah. And I keep this deliberately ambiguous, by the way. What is the best show you've ever seen?
It's a toss-up between Father Ted and the Larry Sanders Show.
Okay. This was a submitted one, I should point this out. This is not the one I normally ask everyone.
Yeah, and the updated Battlestar Galactica.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I don't normally ask everyone this question, because that would be weird. What is your favourite episode of On the Hour / The Day Today / Brass Eye? And do you have a favourite reporter name?
Iggy Pop Barker.
Right.
And is there I think the first episode of On the Hour, because it had a train crash thing in it, and it was just new, and as we were making it, we felt it was new. And
I'm literally seeing Chortle go, Armando loves train crashes.
and we knew it was like, in terms of subject matter for a Radio 4 comedy, it was wrong. You know, it was making fun of people being injured in horrible... You know, there was something about it. But also the other... new aspects of the show. I kind of, you know, as we were making it, we're thinking, no idea what kind of an audience here, but we think this is kind of a bit different. So I suppose that would be my favorite.
What is the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you overcome it?
Biggest mistake I ever made was probably, well, I think it's when I accepted a BBC job. When I went into BBC management, but I quickly overcame it by leaving.
Good way of overcoming a job.
I also, as I was in my last year, I was given a pilot to make called Le Euro Quiz, which was a quiz about Europe. And you can't make Europe entertaining. And I thought, and I was still a staff producer then, I thought, what I'll do is I'll make this pilot badly. Not so bad that they'll think I'm a terrible producer, but bad enough for them to think this idea won't work. We won't commission it as a series. And the mistake I made was I didn't make it bad enough. So they said, we're not sure about this. Can you make another one?
Right.
So I then found myself having to do another pilot for Le Euro Quiz. But this time I knew I was leaving.
Right.
So I just thought I'm going to make the worst, the just the shittest radio pilot that's ever been made. And it was a terrible. The questions were all obscure. The guests were chosen for their inability to be entertaining. We didn't publicize it, so there were about 12 people in the hall. It was bleak. And I loved it. I had a marvelous evening because I knew I was just leaving that world of bleak, just not good enough kind of quizzes. I mean, it was appalling. People who worked on it were traumatized by how bad it was. But I so enjoyed just seeing that whole world go down a sinkhole.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's some men just want to watch the world burn kind of mentality.
Yeah. It was very nice.
What do you think are the most common misconceptions people have about what you do?
Well, like it's two fingers to politicians. Hey, you know, subversive kind of, you know. And I don't see myself as that really at all. I like kind of funny things and, you know, silly, stupid stuff as well. Really, you know, so but you know, I understand how people have that view. You know, I'm always quoted this hard man of satire kind of thing that was written somewhere about 20 years ago. You know, I just think, well, I don't really feel that, and neither do I feel that's what I'm doing, really. I'm just making some funny, hopefully interesting things, you know, for my own personal amusement.
Yeah, and then just sharing them.
Yeah.
Who do you think is the most underrated person in the industry?
Oh, that's interesting. Jeez, I've now got to think about the industry.
Well, it could be as in like a BBC industry type person, or it could be an actual, you know, like a writer type.
Well, I tell you, it's not underrated, but he got a lot of flack recently, and I've mentioned it before, is Alan Yentob, who's actually a great creative, you know, he's actually part of what made the BBC very magical, in that he would be around going, hey, that's good, let's do that. You know, I'll make sure you can do it. When I had stuff for Channel 4 and I finished doing that and I knew I wanted to go back to the BBC, Alan was very instrumental in just getting resources together, so I had my own little mini department where we made stuff. And that's where we made The Thick of It and Time Trumpet and started Comedy Vehicle, Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, you know, and things like that, which I did for about 4 or 5 years there. But I didn't feel like I was BBC staff. I felt like I was an indie, but within the BBC, you know, and he was good at that. And I think people like that, you know, he for some reason he attracts this kind of, you know, especially from the press who are anti-BBC, he's a kind of target for them. And, you know, a lot of people will testify to a lot of the supportive work he did and still does, just encouraging people.
What do you think is the biggest problem in the comedy industry and how would you go about solving it?
Oh, Lord. I mean, there's lots of it.
Okay.
There really is.
Problems.
I mean, you say comedy industry and, you know, the clues in the title, industry. It's become this serious thing and, you know, it has been for a while and that makes it very competitive. And, you know, comedy should be fun. You should enjoy it. You should enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know.
So
I don't know what the solution is.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But yeah.
Yeah, solution is get day jobs and not worry about the
money. just see it as not a job, even though it is, but to try and tell yourself it isn't.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. When you look back over your career, what memory makes you most happy?
Oh, career. Jesus.
Like when you look back over the last 40 years, what's memory? You don't want to call it a career.
Well, you see, this is a recent one. I've just finished doing The Death of Stalin, this film, and Michael Palin plays Molotov in it. And I really, and there's lots of great cast in it, Steve Buscemi, and, you know, but I really, really enjoyed working with Michael Palin, who's just one of my, you know, all-time comedy heroes, who turns out to be as talented and as amazing and as nice as you hoped he would be, and who is funny and who is just great to work with. It was, you know, it was great.
What is the most interesting thing you do that nobody ever gets to see?
Jeez.
Why is that one funny?
I don't know. I mean, I'm into astronomy, but not in a huge way. It's not like I'm out at 4 a.m. staring at stars, but I like that. I don't know. Music, classical music, that's the thing I can plug and bring up.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
All my writing about classical music for the last
really smooth
15 years is coming out next year.
Do you have a name for it?
I don't have a name for it yet.
Okay, right.
Maybe we should crowdsource the name.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. If you have any suggestions of the name, tweet, what's your Twitter handle again?
It's @AYanucci.
Right, tweet @AYanucci. Yes. And hashtag it book title suggestion. Actually, that's a shit hashtag.
Music book title suggestion. Although that's most of your 140 letters gone.
That's more, how about we just do ATI book name suggestions?
Fine.
All right, that sounds like code. Yeah, because that's the industry.
I see, right.
All right, fine. Let's just stick with the thing. Okay. So hashtag music book titles. Do you know what I love is if this trends, if people start like renaming books.
Can we compress it? Mital.
Mital. How do you spell that? Mital. I don't even know how you spell
it. M-I-T-L-E. Mital.
M-I-T-L-E.
Yeah.
Right. So you Mital. Tweet him hashtag M-I-T-L-E.
Yeah.
Any suggestions you have for what would be a book that would encompass the last 15 years of you writing about music?
Yes.
Okay. And any, are you a favour of a pun in a book title or anything like that?
No.
Okay, so no puns.
No.
Any hints as to what you might enjoy in a book title? Just so people can get some good ideas.
Something like I Got Rhythm, something like that.
I Got Rhythm, okay.
Rhythm Method. There you go. There you go.
So not that.
Not that. Right. That's base camp in terms of.
There goes both my ideas. Right?
The quality threshold.
Okay.
It has to be high. That stuff set the bar really low there.
What I'll do is I will link to the page on Amazon that has all your books.
Okay.
So people can just click through in the future.
Yeah, fine.
And they can find it. Okay. This is a two-part.
One day Amazon will have drones that deliver me these books that I haven't written.
Just bring you a script and go sign it.
There you go.
Yeah. Right, this is the last case.
Our algorithms thought you would come up with this.
Yeah. We've looked at your past tweets and you worked it out. Right, this is the...
If you wrote that, then you definitely will have written this.
Oh, man. This is the last question. It's a sort of split two-parter, but it's what is the best bit of advice you've ever been given? And if you could go back to your past self when you were first starting out and give yourself one bit of advice, what would it have been?
First, best bit of advice was something Paul Merton said when I met him very early on doing Have I Got News For You. And he said, writing, it's what I said earlier, actually. It's like, if you're starting off writing, keep writing. Don't stop. Don't wait for someone to ask you to write something. Keep writing, because the more you write, the better you'll get.
Okay.
That's the bit of advice I always pass on. Mm-hmm. A bit of advice to me, starting.
So if you went back to your past self,
I think not come across as being so arrogant and actually genuinely thank people for, you know, their words of advice and for the meeting that they've had with you.
Did you not thank Paul for that bit of advice?
No, I did thank Paul, but I'm just thinking of, like, I remember John Lloyd, who's a great comedy hero of mine, because, you know, he did Not Look Like News, Spitting Image, Blackadder, and he... when we were making the day-to-day, he kind of just out of sheer, you know, wanted it to be good, came in and chatted to us about his experience. And I think, because he then said this afterwards, I think Chris and I must have been looking at him as if to say, who the fuck do you think you are coming to tell? And that wasn't what we were thinking. We were thinking, oh my God, that's John Lloyd. Mm. But he told us afterwards, oh, I thought you were... I mean, I came in to let you know what I thought, but I sort of got the feeling that you didn't want me there. Mm. And I'm thinking, no. Mm. So my advice to my younger self would be to kind of just, you know, the visual signals I'm giving off could have been a lot better.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was Armando. I have to say that I want to say something quickly before I recap the episode. As more high-profiling guests come on the show, it's amazing to see who says yes and who says no. And I've got nothing against anyone who says no. I get it. We're all living busy lives, and sometimes you just have to turn stuff down. I have to turn stuff down sometimes, and it's a pain, but it's just a fact of life. You can't do everything because you've only got a limited amount of time on this planet. So I get it. But it's a testament to the famous people, or the people who are becoming more famous, who are coming on either now, who've been recorded, or are future guests in the pipeline, who ask questions about the show before coming on, such as, how active is the community? What do they want to know? How can I help? Rather than questions I sometimes get from PRs, or I sometimes get from people who have an agenda they're trying to push, which is essentially just reach for a product they're trying to sell, and that is, what are your download numbers? which are publicly available anyway. So anyone who has access to Google, which you would have to if you contacted me anyway, could find those numbers out. So by asking me, it seems, first of all, like you haven't done your research, but it just seems mad to me that that's the vanity number they want to focus on. So I'm self-selecting, and I don't want to bash anyone or any company that's approached me on behalf of someone, because that's not fair, and I know that it's their job, and I know that that's just the way they want to run their work and stuff. I just think it's really interesting how people approach podcasters versus how they might approach someone on quote-unquote mainstream radio. And as this continues to be part of my work and my job as a performer, and the reason it continues to be great and enjoyable and lovely is because of the amazing, open and humble guests who come on because they want to improve the industry by imparting their knowledge. Those are the kind of people I want to surround myself with, and given both myself and Armando both believe that you're the average of the five people you hang out with most, and the content you produce has a massive impact on you and the way that you turn out, I think it's a good way to continue this project. By self-selecting the right people for the project that I want to put out there that represents me and what I'm trying to do, and as a result, self-selecting the audience for it who want to learn and grow, no matter what their relationship is with comedy, whether they be an audience member, a promoter, a booker, a TV commissioner, an act, just a fanatical lover of comedy, whatever you may be. Thank you for listening. It means the world, and I hope that this gives you a lot of value. I spoke to him off mic after the podcast for a bit, and he said, seriously, if you've got any book titles, do tweet him using the hashtag MITLE. That's MITLE. Quickly write that down. MITLE. You know, you can find his and my Twitter handle by just searching the internet, or you can go to the show notes, which are linked in the description. Send him in some example titles. They can be sarcastic, they can be genuine. He hasn't got a title for it yet, and as he said in the podcast, he hasn't really got anything to promote in this one. The book's not out till next year. It's not like a useful promotional tool for him. So if you just enjoyed this and you don't have a book title suggestion, but you just want to say thank you, please do send him a tweet and say thank you. And that goes for all the previous guests. All of them have given up their time and their effort to help us. So take a minute at the end of this podcast and do me a favor, just to help the podcast grow, and also just do something nice for the world. Just push some love out there, push some good vibes into the universe by thanking someone who was on an episode that you particularly enjoyed. As always, you should subscribe. As always, you should subscribe, because I do 3 new pods a month. Please rate it in iTunes. We've been sat on 54 ratings for a while now, and I really want to get it over 60 by the end of the second year, which is happening in a few weeks. Can't believe we're nearly 2. It's flown by, believe me, way too quickly. So if you can help with that, that'd be amazing. Also, please share this episode or any episode that you've enjoyed with someone that you think will get some value out of it. A lot of work goes into these shows. I lose about a day and a half to each of them between contacting the guest for the first time, recording it, editing it, uploading it, promoting it. Just the whole process takes me probably 18 hours for every episode. So that will help me and help the show immensely. If you can support the show, please do. If you want to become a patron going into year 2, please do. You can do that from $1 an episode. That's 80p. If you're English, and you, I should point out, you can cap that. So if you can only afford $2 a month, sorry, it's in dollars because it's an American website. So if you can only afford $2 a month, you can set it and say, I don't want to ever spend more than $2 a month on podcasts, and I won't get more than 2. But that helps. Every little bit helps. If my regular listenership all donated $1 per episode, I would be breaking even on the time that this takes, on the effort it takes, on the equipment maintenance, on just all of it. If you all donated $1, so don't think, if you're sitting there going, it's going to make me look a bit stingy just sending $1. It won't, because if everyone did it, that's the power of the crowd, and it really helps out. And it really helps me out, because it means that I have a budget for the future of the show. So if you can afford, don't do it if you can't afford it, but if you can afford it, please do become a patron from $1 a show. Remember, I only do 3 episodes a month, so that's $3 or £2.40, assuming the Brexit leave doesn't screw up the exchange rate anymore. So please do. If you don't want to do that, by the way, you can do a one-off donation. Again, don't feel like whatever you're sending is too small. Every little bit helps. You can do that on PayPal on my website, or you can give me cash at a gig. A couple of people have done that because they said they didn't want to pay online, or they don't know how to, which is fine, and that's an option. I really don't mind. Just look me up on my website. There's a gig list there. If I'm coming to your town, come down, and even if you can't come to the gig, just tell me you want to meet outside, like some sort of backstreet drug deal. Just sort of slip me £10, £50, £5, whatever you can afford, slip me that, right? Also, my book's about to go on sale. Kindle haven't given me a specific date, but it is all signed off. So if you bought a copy, you should be getting it any day now if you were part of the crowdfunding. Thank you a billion for taking part in that. That really helped with that whole process. It should be with some people by this point. So if it isn't, just give it a few more days. It should be with you very, very soon. I'm sorry about delay. Been a buck up at Kindle's end, which I know sounds like I'm passing the buck, but I can show you the information. It's so annoying. They're just, I'm gonna write a blog post about how to publish books or self-publish books soon, so you'll be able to see that and see why Kindle are not the most efficient that they should be. So if you would like a copy of How to Make a Living by Working for Free, An Artist's Guide to Building an Audience Through Free Content Online, and then how to get that audience to support you if it is something they value, please go to my website and buy a copy for £5 digitally or £8 in paperback plus posts and packaging. All the information on the website. This next bit makes me feel a little uneasy because, okay, very quick story time. I was in Edinburgh in August, as a lot of us were, and I got chatting to a group of comedians who are all fans of the podcast in various capacities. Some are dedicated listeners who've heard every episode, some pick and choose what they want because it helps them, and that's fine either way, because that's the idea of this. It's kind of a choose your own comedy industry adventure. But one of them said, how do you juggle admin, as in booking your live stuff, and podcasting, given the amount of time it takes you to do? And I honestly said, sometimes it takes a hit, and sometimes I have to get ahead of myself to catch up with admin and vice versa, and sometimes I just sleep less because I need an extra couple of hours to do that. This is not a sob story, by the way. This is not like, please pity me. But one of them said, well, a lot of industry listen to your podcast. Why don't you ask if any of them want to book you? Because there's probably some of them listening who like what you're doing, maybe have looked you up online, and you just haven't contacted them, and they don't know that you would like to gig for them, but just haven't emailed in yet. That's what I'm doing now. I feel slightly uncomfortable about doing this, but it's been 2 months or 3 months since Edinburgh, and it's been fermenting in the back of my mind, and I sort of thought, you know what, let's try it and see. So if you are someone who runs a gig, or if you are someone who knows someone who runs a gig, and you would like to help me out admin wise and you would like to contact me for booking me, I can send you through all the details you might need. I've got quotes, I've got competition credits for awards I've come close to winning, and I've got videos of me performing, hours, tens, twenties, whatever you need to see. So if you're interested in booking me for paid and progression work, I'd love to hear from you. If you aren't, but you just want to say thank you for the episode, you can tweet me or Facebook me, and that would be very greatly appreciated as well. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for supporting. Thank you very much for donating if you do. I will see you all in about 10 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.